This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. Welcome to the Science Podcast for July 13th, 2018. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, news writer Daniel Clary talks with us about a high-energy neutrino detected by the Ice Cube facility in Antarctica and its potential source, which was confirmed by other observations. And Susan McCooch is here to talk about her paper on what makes deep water rice grow so tall when it's submerged in water. How does it know it's underwater? And how does it know how tall to get? First up, we have staff writer Daniel Clary. He's here to take us to the Ice Cube neutrino detector in Antarctica, where this past September, researchers detected a neutrino that originated in deep space. Hi, Daniel.
Hi.
So Ice Cube is actually made of ice. How is it used to detect neutrinos?
Well, neutrinos are really, really hard to detect because they don't interact with normal matter hardly at all. You know, they're tiny subatomic particles, very, very light, and they travel at nearly the speed of light, and they just zip through things without noticing. There are something like a trillion of them passing through every person every day. So you have them flying through you all the time. And they just can pass through the Earth, and most of them wouldn't even notice. But very, very occasionally, one of them will hit, you know, a proton or a neutron in an atomic nucleus. And then there's a shower of debris. And when that happens, it emits light because this debris has to decelerate from this really high speed. And so it sheds lots of light and you can detect that light. And that's how you see a neutrino. You need a very large amount of material, transparent material, in the hope that one of these collisions will happen. And so Ice Cube is a cubic kilometer of ice underneath the South Pole. So they just sort of drilled down holes into the ice with hot water and then lowered light detectors into those holes in something like 86 different places and then just left them there looking at the ice. And that was, you know, 8 years ago, and it's been scanning for neutrinos ever since.
And it has caught one that has some very interesting history, we think. The key here was to try to tell where it came from. You know, we don't want local neutrinos, right? We want deep space neutrinos. So what was the key to finding out that it was from, you know, another place?
This was the goal of building Ice Cube. It was meant to be a telescope for neutrinos. So we know that neutrinos are produced in nuclear reactions. So we can see the ones that come from nuclear reactors and from the sun. And in 1987, we detected some from the supernova that went off not too far away in that year. And that was the first time people had detected any from beyond our solar system. So they knew they should be able to get some from more distant sources. And that's really valuable because they're created in very violent situations, which astronomers are always interested in. And, but they go in such a straight line because they're not deflected by magnetic or electric fields. They're not scattered by anything. They just come here straight from where they're created. So if we could detect them, that would have important information about where they were created. Ice Cube detects lots of neutrinos because there are some created in the atmosphere and by the sun, but they're looking for the really high energy ones that have come from deep space. And they do it by looking for the track of this debris as it flies through the ice. And then they can reconstruct the track that the neutrino would have followed if it had continued. And then they can look back along that track to a point on the sky where they think the neutrino came from. And they've done this many times and never seen anything that was an obvious source. But last September, they found one that did.
How did they then zero in on what they think is the source?
Well, they had to get help from other observatories. So when they find one that is interesting, that's high energy, and they get a good track from it, they send out an alert that goes to astronomers all around the world. And, you know, if they're interested in following it up, they can turn their telescopes and take a look. In this case, a few telescopes did have a look and didn't see anything. But then the Fermi Gamma Ray Observatory, which is an orbiting telescope put up by NASA, they took a look up there and they knew there was a thing called a blazar up there, which is a really bright source of high energy radiation. They knew that a while ago it had started flaring up, it got more active, and they took a look and it was still active. And so it was very close to the point in the sky that this neutrino was possibly coming from, only half a degree away. And so they made the connection, and suddenly lots of other telescopes got interested, and they were able to observe it at all different sorts of wavelengths, you know, radio, optical. And everyone was looking at this blazar and learned a lot about it. So,
What exactly is a blazar besides a bright, high energy source of somethings?
well, it's a blazar produces its energy from a supermassive black hole. So this is a black hole that sits at the center of a galaxy, like the one in our galaxy. But the difference is that in these very active galaxies, the black hole's eating lots of material. So it's consuming dust and gas. As it's falling in, it gets heated to a huge temperature and shines in very brightly, all this material that's falling in. There are many galaxies known as quasars, which are like that. They've got a black hole which is in a feeding frenzy and so producing lots of radiation. A blazar is different because some of the energy is being funneled into jets that come out of the poles of the quasar. And if that jet just happens to be pointing straight at us, we see this really bright source of radiation coming our way because we're in the line of sight of that jet.
What that jet is sending our way, one of the things is neutrinos. So what is being able to sense or detect a neutrino coming from a blazar? What's the importance of that?
Well, it'll teach us something about blazars and what's happening in the jets. You know, physicists are very interested in how these jets form and what it is that's flying out in the jet. They suspect that there are particles, you know, protons and nuclei of small atoms that are being, you know, fired out by the magnetic field of the black hole in this jet. And some of those particles could form cosmic rays, which are another phenomenon that is bombarding Earth all the time. So these are particles that hit the atmosphere of the Earth every so often and again produce a shower of particles. And Very, very occasionally, there's a really, really high energy one of these cosmic rays hits the atmosphere, and astronomers have no idea where they come from and how they could have this colossal energy. They're about a million times more powerful than the particles produced in particle accelerators like CERN's Large Hadron Collider. They're another mystery. But what astronomers think is happening is that if these particles are being fired out of the jet from a blazar, some of them are colliding with other atoms surrounding the blazar and producing neutrinos. So, in the same place where these cosmic rays are being created, neutrinos are created as well. So, if you find the source of neutrinos, that's pointing you to the source of the cosmic rays as well. Well, that's the theory.
Also, we can get a handle on cosmic rays somehow.
Yes, that's right.
Very cool. So, one other thing that I wanted to mention from the study that we're talking about here is that to back up this finding, they went back through their archives, their old data, to see if any neutrinos had come out of this blazar before and just happened to have written a signature on the ice. What did they find when they did that?
They had a search back because Ice Cube has been operating for 8 years and no more than that, 9 years, I think. So they had a lot of tracks that, they hadn't known their significance. So they were just sitting in the archives. So now that they knew a direction that they were interested in, they looked back and they found a period of 6 months from 2014 to 2015 where there was an excess of neutrinos coming from that point in the sky. So they think that possibly that blazar was flaring up at that time and again producing excess neutrinos that we captured. If that proves to be true, those neutrinos can be added to what we know about this blazar, and maybe we can learn something about the neutrinos and the cosmic rays.
So this is support because, I mean, basically this is a single observation that they're using to say this is a neutrino from that blazar. Is there more that they can do to confirm that?
Absolutely. I mean, they can look for more neutrinos, and now they know the direction they're coming in. They can keep particularly alert for things coming from that direction. But also, other observatories can also keep looking. Gamma ray observatories are watching it and have made some detections. They can keep looking for more X-rays and all right across the spectrum from there to radio waves. So, the more they learn about this blazar and everything that's coming out of it, the more we'll get to understand about these objects as sources of high energy particles.
This really, for me, has echoes of what happened with LIGO, a multi-messenger finding where you find one signal and then you follow it up with other observations.
Absolutely. That's what everyone is saying, that it's just another great example of how, by combining all this data from different sources, you learn much more than if a single one had made these observations. And in a way, this is more of a multi-messenger detection than even LIGO was. The LIGO people knew they'd seen gravitational waves, but Ice Cube didn't know it had seen anything interesting until Fermi had said that, hey, we've seen something up there too. And then suddenly, because they had these two things, they knew they had something interesting, and then everybody else joined in.
So they had half the story, and it wasn't just confirmation, it was the other half of the story that
Yeah,
was
that's
coming from
right.
the EMS. Very cool. All right. Well, thank you, Daniel Clary, so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Daniel Clary is a staff writer for Science. You can find links to his story and the Blazar research papers at sciencemag.org/podcast. Stay tuned for an interview with Susan Makuch about the secret to rice's ability to keep its head above water. This week's episode is brought to you in part by LifeProof Backpacks. Whatever the action, wherever the destination, no matter the weather, LifeProof Backpacks keep you optimized, organized, prepared, and protected. Check them out at lifeproof.com/sciencemag and receive 15% off any pack. LifeProof backpacks are made with water-repellent Cordura fabric to shed rain during rainy summer afternoons. Special tech pockets are sealed against the elements and lined with soft fabric so phones and other devices stay safe inside. Select backpacks also have an ingenious side-access laptop pocket, ideal for when you're going through airport security. And speaking of security, most LifeProof backpacks are equipped with a super secret stash pocket for when you need to hide away a passport or some cash. And they're all outfitted with front tie-downs to hold oversized stuff on the outside of your bag. With four sizes, there's a LifeProof backpack for any outing. Grab the Keto 18 liter for day trips, up your carrying capacity with the Squamish 20 liter, go with the Goa 22 liter for tons of pockets, or max out on space with the Squamish XL 32 liter. Get your LifeProof backpack now at a 15% discount by going to lifeproof.com/sciencemag. LifeProof backpacks, carry on. I've killed a lot of houseplants by overwatering them, but some plants, like rice, are adapted to periodic flooding and can live in over 10 feet of water. Susan McCooch and colleagues write about the signaling pathway that underlies deep water rice's reactions to high waters. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what happens when the water comes? How does rice respond to suddenly finding itself submerged?
We have to start out by just reminding people that rice evolved as an aquatic plant. So it's very used to living in watery environments. But floods are obviously too much water, right? And rice has evolved two different strategies. It has a response to flash floods where it's only submerged for a short period of time by basically holding its breath and stopping its growth so it can survive the flood for up to 2 weeks. And the other response is that it basically escapes by outgrowing the flood.
Why is it bad for a plant to be submerged in water? What can't it do?
So most plants actually cannot survive much flooding at all because they can't get oxygen. Mm-hmm. And so they need to keep their growing tips above the water. The roots need oxygen as well as the shoots. But rice is very special because it can take oxygen from the shoot and transport it down into the root. So that's why rice can grow in a flooded paddy, which is an anaerobic soil. There's no oxygen freely available in that soil because it can transport it down to the roots.
Wow. What kind of places do people grow deep water rice?
So today it's mostly grown in Asia. It evolved in South and Southeast Asia, and there are over 100 million people who depend on it for sustenance. It's grown on about 35,000 square miles or 90,000 square kilometers of land. And the countries where it's found, in countries like Bangladesh, Burma, Myanmar, we call it today, Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia, it can account for up to 25% of the land used to grow rice during this rainy season.
Let's talk a little bit about what your research is about. What were you looking for with this paper? I mean, it was known that rice decides to grow real tall when some kinds of rice grow real tall when they're submerged in water. What part of that were you looking at?
In either case, whether rice is going to hold its breath, so to speak, and withstand submergence by not growing, or whether it's going to grow rapidly to outgrow rising floodwaters, in both cases, it was known that ethylene gas is the trigger that rice is responding to do one of those two responses. Mm-hmm. But it was not known how that related to the hormone response, which it was already known was controlled by gibberellic acid. And so what we were investigating was the mechanism by which the accumulation of ethylene causes the gibberellic response of rapid growth, rapid what we call internode elongation, to keep that rice rising with rising waters, but never rising if the waters are not rising.
Getting back to the sensing question, how does the rice know it's underwater?
That's the really interesting thing. So normally plants that are growing in the air are emitting ethylene in the form of a gas, and it dissipates very readily in air. But when a plant is submerged, the ethylene moves very slowly in water, and mm-hmm. that leads to a buildup of ethylene around the plant. And that increase in concentration of ethylene in water is sensed by the plant via what we call the ethylene signaling pathway. And that's what we were investigating, is exactly how the plant senses the buildup of ethylene gas because the water doesn't allow it to dissipate quickly, and then how that leads to the response, the appropriate response, and it's a very quantitative response.
How are you able to pick apart this pathway and find out what molecules were important for this process?
Well, the first thing we did was just basic genetics. We used genome-wide association and we used biparental QTL mapping. And we found a major signal on chromosome 1 that mapped down to, fine mapped down to about a 5 kb region, which targeted what we call the semi-dwarf 1 gene. But what's so curious about that gene is that that gene has long been known as the Green Revolution gene, and we refer to it as the semi-dwarf gene. And yet in this case, that same gene was co-opted for a very different function. So it's a completely different allele that causes rapid elongation in the case of deep water rice. But in the case of the very high yielding Green Revolution rices, it caused the rice plant to maintain a very dwarfed stature during its vegetative growth period. So it has both functions.
So was it selected for in the Green Revolution? How did it become a prominent gene in that situation?
It was the target of selection. It was the primary target of selection, and primarily because it allowed the plants to produce a very large amount of grain with much smaller investments of energy in leaf and stem. Hmm. So that caused higher yields in the land, and it also led to just a basic ratio shift in how that plant allocated resources.
And it sounds like it's doing something similar here, but it's saying we need to grow very, very, very tall in order to get the rice out.
Right. So when the ethylene builds up in water, the plant senses that increase in concentrations of ethylene, and that allows it to then transcribe what we call a transcription factor, which is known as an ethylene insensitive gene that then binds to the promoter of what we call this semi-dwarf 1 gene. And it is that transcription factor that determines how much of the gibberellic, this hormone that either causes rapid elongation or dwarfism. Mm-hmm. And that's the trigger. That's the thing that determines when, where, and how much of that hormone is produced. But what I think is most exciting in terms of this paper is that we've unraveled, or we're starting to unravel, a very complex mechanism by which the plant not only responds to its environment, but it knows how much to respond. So Right. It's truly in tune with that environment. And if the floods don't come, the rice doesn't bother to elongate.
One thing you also looked at in this paper was where these alleles came from, right? Where the origin of this ability was globally. What did you find out about that?
Once we had clarified what was the haplotype, as we call it, what was the particular allele at the SD1 gene and its promoter that was identifiable in these deep water rices and that differed from the non-deep water rices, we were able to ask, in which populations of wild ancestors do we find that allele? But the exciting thing was that we found that allele in populations of wild rice that were endemic throughout much of Southeast Asia, but almost all clustered around the Bangladeshi Delta region. And so we found that the origin existed in the wild stands and was presumably the target of selection for these very special deep water rices that are very beautifully adapted to these flooding, deep flooded areas, which flood, by the way, every single wet season they flood. If you don't mind, I'd just like to make a connection to what's in the news today, because many people around the world will have heard about the Thai soccer boys, the 12 boys and their coach who've been trapped in that cave in Thailand. And that is partly because these same floods are occurring during the rainy season. And it's that area of Thailand where the rice paddies typically flood, and it's these same rains, and they come at this same time of year every year. And that is the shift in ecosystem, and it dramatically changes the entire river delta, the entire northern part of Thailand, and the rice paddies and the people whose livelihoods depend on them during this season of the year plant these deep water rices.
I think another point we should talk about is, you know, what this variability in rice gets us. So the idea that you are able to consult wild rice and look for the alleles there, and the fact that there are all these different kinds of rice all over the world, it means that there's some flexibility in this crop.
Yeah, there's an amazing potential, I think, as we face the rigors and the extreme fluctuations in climate these days, to look at the wild ancestors of our cultivated crops and really take a lesson from how they have learned, if you will, to respond to their environment. They inhabit all kinds of unusual and sometimes extreme environments, and rice is a pretty good example of that. not just in terms of water, but in terms of cold and heat and salt and drought and many other forms of stress. And the wild ancestors can show us a lot. So for a rice breeder looking for climate resilience, one of the ways in which I think we can learn from nature is to look very carefully at the way that the wild ancestors and the populations that exist with less rather than more human care are able to respond to environment and take some lessons about how we might then modify our varieties through selection or any other form of genetics to adjust and adapt them to the needs of the future climate.
Okay. So what's next for your group? Are you going to continue to study this particular process in deep water rice?
So actually, we want to just mention our large number of Japanese collaborators. And this is a large team of people who've been looking at the questions of rice, both in its semi-dwarf and in its elongating and in its ability to survive underwater. And we will continue to look at all these extreme forms of adaptation to climate. And we find it extremely illuminating. And I will say it's also quite humbling to take a look at what nature can do if you give it a little bit of time. And if the genetic variation is there, if the variety, if the genetic diversity is there to begin with, selection, both natural selection and human selection, can do amazing things.
Susan McCooch, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Sarah. It was wonderful to have this chance to talk to you.
Susan McCooch is a professor of plant breeding and genetics, plant biology, biological statistics, and computational biology at Cornell University. You can find a link to her research at sciencemag.org/podcast. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, many other places, or listen to us on the Science site. On the site, you can also find links to the research and news stories discussed in the episode. That's sciencemag.org/podcasts. The show was produced by Sarah Crespi and edited by Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.